This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the century's greatest creative minds, Orson Welles. Director, actor, writer. His Citizen Kane is widely regarded as the greatest film ever made. And his 1938 Halloween Eve radio broadcast of The War of the Worlds was a great early lesson in the power of viral media. The broadcast takes listeners to a strange happening at the Wilmoth Farm, Groversville, New Jersey.
What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission.
That was a clip from the famous War of the Worlds broadcast. Well, the University of Michigan has become a hotbed of Orson Welles-related activity, including an upcoming three-day symposium celebrating this 100th birthday. Brad Schwartz is with us now. His book is Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News. Brad, so good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I think a lot of us would be surprised to realize that the University of Michigan has really become a center for Welles-related research and writing, of which you're one of the leaders. How did that happen?
It happened through the efforts of a professor named Catherine Benamou, who used to be here at the University of Michigan but is now at UC Irvine. She did a lot of research with one of Welles's unfinished films, It's All True, which was a documentary he did during World War II about South America as part of the Good Neighbor policy. We didn't want South America to go into the fascist column. So he and other artists worked to build a bridge, a cultural bridge between them and us. And she did a lot of work with Welles' producing partner, Richard Wilson, who had worked on that film and wanted to make sure that what remained of that footage saw the light of day. And in getting to know him, she convinced him to donate a lot of this material that he had preserved from Welles's career, all kinds of stuff, you know, letters, documents, photographs, scripts, everything that he still had to the University of Michigan. And once he did that, then Oya Kodar, who is Welles's partner and collaborator for the latter part of his life, decided that she the materials that she had could find a good home here as well.
Well, I bet she had some great stuff.
She did, and more stuff that she recently gave to the university. And then once those two kinds of collections came here, then other people, Welles' daughter, Chris Welles Fetter, donated some stuff, someone he worked with on, I believe, Chimes at Midnight. And so as these different collections have come in from different people, we've really kind of built the largest collection of archival material related to Orson Welles in the world. And it's made us, as you said, a center, I think, of Welles research.
And in those papers recently donated by Welles' partner, there there was something no one knew was around. He was actually working on an autobiography?
This is true. Those were, yes, from Oya Kodar, just announced, just acquired by the university. They're still going through, I believe, 8 boxes of material, of which the memoir is part of it. And in this event that's coming up will be the first public reading of material from that memoir.
Now, as a U of M undergrad, I know you uncovered a trove of long-forgotten letters that I'd say gives us a much more realistic look at the actual response of the nation to that famous War of the Worlds broadcast of 1938, which then led to your book, Broadcast Hysteria. Give us an idea, Brad, what's in the letters? Who wrote them?
People, all kinds of people from all over the United States and a few from outside the country. That show is famous, as you alluded to, for supposedly causing this nationwide mass panic.
That's certainly what the newspapers the next day, they reserve those huge headlines like war breaks out, those kind of headlines.
Yes, that made Orson Welles into an international celebrity, and you don't have Citizen Kane, you don't have so many of the stuff that he did without that. But when you look at what people actually wrote describing their experiences, because the show made headlines the next day, as you said, because it became this national event, a lot of people felt the need to write in describing their experiences. And there are, you know, a few hundred letters from people who were frightened and talk about, you know, how terrified they were and running to, you know, put the kids in the car and get out of town and all that. So that did happen in some rare instances. But in the larger sense, you know, most people who heard the show were not frightened and wrote to Wells and also to the FCC to talk about that. And they revealed these much larger fears they had about what this said about the power of media and these concerns that I think are still very much with us today in the age of the internet, this notion that when communication moves much faster than we are used to and it's getting faster all the time, when somebody can use this new medium to do something that sounds realistic but is not, what are the dangers and the risks that can pose to democracy, essentially? And that's something that they dealt with then, something that we're still dealing with today.
If not more so.
Very much so.
It is interesting when you think that we're kind of used to fake news, you know, Jon Stewart or The Onion.
Yes.
But people fall for it, click on it, tweet it, do whatever, spread it, and then
yes.
realize, oops, that wasn't real. So we really, even though we're sophisticated, we're falling for things in much the same way people in 1938 did.
Yeah, there's this – people tend to think of the War of the Worlds broadcast as kind of, you know, the rubes in 1938
yeah.
falling for it.
Yeah.
But I don't think we are any more sophisticated now than the people who did fall for it back then. You know, there are letters – in the U of M collection from doctors and lawyers and people saying, I have a college degree and you still frighten me. So that impulse, and it really is, you know, I talk a lot in the book about how it, as you said, was this kind of viral media event mm-hmm. where it wasn't so much the broadcast, it was the way people shared it, the way they ran next door, the way they called their relatives and said, you got to tune in. That was really the driver of fear, the way people picked it up and spread it. But at the same time, as I said, that was, you know, the fright, the hysteria was existed, but it was smaller than people tend to think. And the larger story, mm-hmm. the headlines and kind of the narrative of the nationwide mass panic, that was fake news of a much larger and more serious kind.
Put out by legitimate news
exactly
organizations.
Exactly right. And that's something that's very much still with us today. You know, the our 21st century press tend to exaggerate stories and misreport them in the way that the news media did, and kind of create these hysterias that that maybe we shouldn't experience. And that, you know, I hope what people learn from the book and from the War of the Worlds episode is to realize both, you know, you shouldn't believe the alarming tweet, but maybe, you know, the breaking news isn't always breaking news, and you need to be aware of that.
I'm talking with Orson Welles historian Brad Schwartz, whose book is Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News. And as we look ahead to the upcoming three-day symposium at the University of Michigan marking the 100th anniversary of Welles' birth, what is it, Brad, about Orson Welles that drew you in so?
It was really the event, the War of the Worlds. You know, I learned from a librarian here, Phil Hallman, who now curates these collections and others related to filmmakers, that they had all these letters. I had grown up listening to a lot of old-time radio. That's what my parents would play to get me to go to sleep at night. So when Phil said, we have all these letters related to War of the Worlds, I mean, that's the most famous radio show of all time. That immediately, you know, I wanted to know what was in there. And I discovered that the story of War of the Worlds was much more complex and textured than anybody had ever really thought. But as I, you know, I came to this as a fan of old-time radio, but not really a fan of Orson Welles. I became a fan of Orson Welles the more I researched him and realized how ahead of his time he consistently was. I mean, he was doing things, whether it was in theater, radio, or film, that people weren't doing for decades after the fact. And it's difficult to understand how revolutionary he was, because so much of what he did we accept now. I mean, what he was doing in Citizen Kane, not just, you know, in the photography and the, and, you know, that everybody talks about, and the deep focus and all that, but in the narrative, the idea of telling a story through multiple points of view that's all chopped up chronologically, you know, that's something that that we kind of take for granted now, but people, at least general audiences, didn't really know what to make of it in 1941.
He was a wunderkind, and do you think he burned out early? He expended his genius early, and then – because later in life, things didn't get finished.
No.
I remember reading
Charlton Heston's autobiography when they worked together in Mexico, and there was just nothing but ideas that never came to fruition. I remember reading accounts when he was in Catch 22 and he couldn't memorize his lines. You can tell he's reading off of cue cards as he's playing that corrupt general. And it was kind of, I think, was it in a sad ending to a stellar career?
It was. I mean, I don't think he burned out. I think he was, to the end of his life, as creative as he ever was. I mean, he was always this, as you said, fountain of ideas and writing things down, you know, scripts. And he loved working on creative projects. The problem he had after Citizen Kane was he never had the resources or the control that he had in his first quarter century. You know, the reason Citizen Kane is so perfect and so polished is because he had Final Cut. Any privilege, and he had the resources of a major studio to do what he wanted to do, and he never had that again.
Which surprises me. You would think, okay, he proved himself. He gets Final Cut. He gets those resources.
It didn't make money. That's the thing.
That
partially,
it lost money.
Partially because William Randolph Hearst, who was the subject of the film in a lot of ways, set out to destroy the film and failed, but did hurt it commercially. But also, as I said, because general audiences. Didn't really know what to make of it. It was revolutionary, and how do you promote that? It's not it's a drama. It's experimental.
It's not a Gone with the Wind.
Precisely right. So that was a financial failure, as most of his films were. But I think as in Hollywood, you have they prize creativity, but they prize box office even more. And so this the sense that he had done. Even though Kane was a financial failure, it was a critical success. People at the time said it was the greatest film ever made. So he had that success, and he had this major popular success in War of the Worlds, which was the thing that he was most known for and the thing that defined his reputation, I think, for the rest of his life. And so to have that, when you're 26, which is when how old he was when Kane came out, and then to have all these difficulties later in life, it becomes worse and worse and more difficult to do what he did best. And he said later in life, I've spent 98% of my life hustling for money and 2% actually making movies. And that's, I think, the tragedy of his life. And so what these events that have been held in honor of his centennial and what I think Michigan is going to focus on specifically is showing that he didn't lose that creativity later in his life, that, they will be showing some of his unfinished films, they will be showing some of his later films, and I think people who go to the event will learn that, all that he had going on and that he didn't have the resources to complete.
Give us a sense of the kinds of discussions that will be happening during this three-day symposium. And I know much of this is free and wide open to the public.
Yes, the discussions are the films they will be showing Magnificent Ambersons, Touch of Evil, Chimes at Midnight, which is one of his better films, but which up till now has been very difficult to see in the United States.
Wasn't that the one he did with Heston in Mexico?
No, that was Touch of Evil. Chimes at Midnight is one of his Shakespearean ones about Falstaff. And that's Wells, I think, said, if I had to get into heaven on the basis of one film, that's the film I would offer up. So it's a rare opportunity to see that. It'll be at the DIA on Sunday, June 7th. So those will be part of Cinetopia, but the discussions are focused in large part on the U of M's collections and the people who donated them, but also the people like me who have used them for scholarly purposes.
If you had a chance to sit in this room right now and ask one question of Orson Welles, what would you ask him?
That's he was notoriously slippery when it came to interviews. He once said 75% of what I say in interviews is false. So whatever I asked him, I'm not sure I would get a straight answer, but it would be entertaining. I guess I would like to know more about what was going on in his mind the night of the broadcast and kind of the next day, because that's the crucible out of which Orson Welles, as we kind of know and love him today, came from. And he, in later years, he kind of made light of it and said he always knew what he was doing and he wanted to scare the public. But what you read in interviews and kind of understand from people who were there around him was that he really was scared and that he didn't, the police came into the studio while he's still doing the broadcast. He sees all these reporters who are throwing these questions at him, suggesting that, people have died in these mass stampedes and, people have died from heart attacks and all these other things. So he didn't really know, I don't think at the time, you know, that his career might have been over, or that his life, even, he could have been arrested at any moment. So I would love to know what was actually going on in his head, and what he could have had no idea that this was the thing that would catapult him to Hollywood, but what he thought and what he how he resolved to save himself. I think that would have been a fascinating conversation to have.
Author and Orson Welles historian Brad Schwartz will be one of the moderators at the upcoming U of M symposium celebrating the centennial of filmmaker-actor Orson Welles, June 8th through the 10th at the Hatcher Graduate Library on the U of M campus. Brad, it was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here.